Glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Really happy to have you along today as we begin our program by talking with the authors of the book Finding Freedom, The Untold Story of Joshua Glover, Runaway Slave. And I tell you, the book has lots of Wisconsin connections here, and I'm really pleased to have Ruby West Jackson and Walter T. McDonald, Mac as his friends call him, to be with us. They're co-authors of the book. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Ruby's worked as a teacher, a lecturer, community activist. She's been involved in all kinds of things. Costumed interpreter of pioneer black women in Wisconsin. She received the National Park Service Network to Freedom Award. She's served as the African American History Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society. And she's written and consulted frequently on black history and slave stories. Ruby, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also with us, Walter McDonald, spent 50 years as a forensic psychologist. And over the course of his 30-year collaboration with Ruby, Mac has mapped Underground Railroad routes into and out of Wisconsin. He served as a script consultant for Rope of Sand. And it's a play about Joshua Glover and the Fugitive Slave Act. And it was commissioned by the Wisconsin Supreme Court for its sesquicentennial. And Mac, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you
as well
for having us.
How'd you guys get together in the first place to collaborate?
Ruby, would you like to start that?
Yes, Mac and his family and my family happened to come to Wisconsin in the same year, 1962. And he met my husband, and they got along, and then the families got to know each other. And Mac has worked with me. I can always get him to say, come, let's do this. Let's do this. And so I was working on a number of things, and he was always interested in it, particularly the historic part of it. And he was about to retire and made the mistake of saying, I don't know what I'm going to do with all my time. And I said, I know what you can do. You can come and work with me. And that's how we got started with this. But we were a number of, like, reading is fundamental. We brought to Wisconsin in the 60s and 70s. And he served as a tutor for me when I was getting my master's degree in educational psychology. So
Long history.
We've got a lot of history behind us.
Well, Mac, how did you happen to come to write about and work with Ruby on the story of Joshua Glover? And I have to say, I really enjoyed the book very much. It's a very fascinating story. And I also have to be frank and say I knew nothing about Joshua Glover before I opened the pages of your book.
Neither did most people before Ruby started doing research on him. And she was working on a booklet. She'd been loaned to the state tourism department to do a booklet on Heritage Wisconsin involving things that black people would be interested in seeing in Wisconsin. And in doing that, as she describes it, while in the bowels of the Racine Heritage Museum one day, she found Joshua Glover. And she got very interested, didn't find a lot of information, but what she had interested her. And she said to me, Mac, how would you like to do a book about it? And that's how the history was made. That was 10, 12 years ago.
Yes, I've been working on it all that time.
Yeah, not full-time, obviously, but working on it. And most of the stories about Joshua Glover end with, and he went to Canada and lived happily ever after, so to speak. And they concentrate primarily on the legal issues that were involved and all of the abolitionists who were put on trial for it. We had the good fortune to be able to find where he was in Canada. And that was a lucky streak. I got a census for 1871 for Ontario and went through it one afternoon on my computer. And there I found Joshua Glover in a town called Etobicoke, which is now a sort of a borough or a suburb of Ontario itself. And what do you do when you have something like that? The same thing you tell your kids to do when they have an assignment. Go to the public library. So called the public library in Etobicoke, asked them if they knew anybody who was working with the history of American runaway slaves, gave me a name, I called the place they gave me, which turned out to be a place called Montgomery's Inn, which had been a traveler's inn at the time, and the place where Joshua Glover was employed, which we didn't know at the time. I asked to speak to the lady. They said she is busy baking bread, and her name is Hillary Dawson. She was a docent at the museum and in costume at the time. Explained I came from the States, or was talking from the States, so they got her. Asked her if the name Joshua Glover meant anything to her, and she screamed and dropped the phone. 2 weeks later, we were in Canada.
She knew all about Joshua Glover.
Yes, he wasn't her main topic, but she was very interested in a half a dozen runaway slaves who had settled in the area, of whom he was one.
Well, you know, one of the things let's talk about the book a little bit. And to begin with, one of the things that struck me again, and I hadn't read about it in a long time, but you start out by talking about the sale of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it's disheartening. Well, is the kind word, I guess, is, you know, sort of the mild way to put it. A disheartening way to have to read about how people were treated back in those days.
Yes, it was quite moving for me, and the best part of the book for me, because it takes me back to the beginning of my people and what went through, what they had to go through to even get that freedom, most of them. Except for the 40,000 that escaped to Canada, were subject to the auctions. And if you remember in the book, we state that this kind of auction goes on every New Year's Day throughout the South and some of the border states. So it's very moving and just takes my breath away to think that people were treated that way, and survived, and some of them didn't, of course, but so many made a way for. So that's why we really wanted this book to be one about the runaway slaves, in appreciation to the abolitionists, of course, but to have the sheer guts to walk out of a plantation, knowing that if you don't make it, you're subject to severe punishment.
Very severe punishment. And Joshua Glover was sold to a guy from Missouri, if I'm not
mistaken.
That's correct.
St. Louis. Benamy Stone Garland, who was originally from Lynchburg, Virginia, and like many sons who were not first sons, couldn't expect to inherit. And he came to Missouri very shortly after it was established as a state, and it was established as a slave state at the same time as Maine was a free state, because that's what the government was doing at that time to keep the balance equal. And he came there, bought Joshua on New Year's Day of 1850, and Joshua worked for him for two and a half years. Took it into his head one day in the spring when the boss was out of town that he didn't want to be a slave anymore, and left.
Yeah. And he it was a long walk, and I suppose he got some rides along the way.
Probably did. We know very little about that part of it. We do know that one woman gave him some seed potatoes for food along the journey, and we have his testimony from a court situation that he was in later, that he went at one time 3 days without food on his route to Racine.
And landed in Racine.
Yes.
and spent?
Again, 2 years thereabouts. He left in 52, and he was not captured until the spring of 54 by his owner, who had discovered that he was there.
Yeah, somebody kind of turned him in, Ruby?
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Yes, someone must have turned him in. We suspect that it was one of his, quote, friends, mm-hmm. who was given money to take their master to where Joshua lived in Racine. So he looks pretty guilty because at the capture he was helping the captors to catch Joshua. So we're pretty sure, but we don't like to put anything that it isn't exactly certain. The way it is certain. In the yep. book.
Yeah, and I think we should set some context on this. Well, now, how can he get arrested? Some people may not remember the Fugitive Slave Act. And, Mac, maybe you can talk a little sure. bit about, sort of set that context.
The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and that was either the third or fourth one that had passed since the country was founded, required everyone to give aid to anyone who was attempting to take away a fugitive slave, to give aid to a lawyer, to the law and the police to stop that from happening. And it was a crime that was punishable by up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine if you assisted in robbing someone of their human property. And you figure when average wages for a working person at that time was $300 a year, $1,000 was an enormous fine. So it was regarded as a very serious sort of thing.
And I'm going to break in here for just a second and allow people to join us, as I haven't given that number in a while, or maybe I haven't given it at all yet. Let me do that right now. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment for our guest today, Ruby West Jackson, Walter McDonald, co-authors of Finding Freedom, The Untold Story of Joshua Glover, Runaway Slave, published by University of Wisconsin Press. Please feel free to join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about Joshua Glover and the Underground Railroad today with Ruby West Jackson and Walter McDonald, authors of Finding Freedom, The Untold Story of Joshua Glover, Runaway Slave. I said it was published by the University of Wisconsin Press. That's a mistake. It's actually published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and I want to make sure that we have that correct. So it's Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. If questions about the Underground Railroad or Joshua Glover, we'd be or the times that they're writing about, we'd be happy to hear from you. And I know, Ruby, you wanted to talk a little bit more about the Fugitive Slave Act, or give us a little more context on that.
I just want to add that the Fugitive Slave Act enforced should be was directed to all people, not only policemen and people who were employed, you know, in that capacity, but regular people, everyday people. They were penalized if they were not there to assist the master in capturing their runaway slaves.
So everybody was sort of instantly deputized or were supposed exactly. to be. Mm-hmm. And yeah. if they didn't help, they could be subject to
fine or imprisonment, yes.
That's right.
So he was taken as, and kind of roughly, as a matter of fact. He was
that he very was. Roughly.
Yeah, he was beaten up quite badly.
And he, in the meantime, he had made, you know, he'd been there 2 years in Racine and had made some friends there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess they were kind of eager to get him out of there.
Actually, very much so. They took him to a jail in Milwaukee for that reason, because they felt the Racine jail was so flimsy that it would be easy to break him out of it. And shortly after they took him to Milwaukee, they lost their way. So it took them several hours to get there, and it was beyond dawn of the next day before they made it, which gave people a chance to telegraph ahead to Milwaukee about what had happened. So in both places, in Racine, at what is now Monument Square and was called then Haymarket Square, there was a protest meeting of a couple of hundred people. And when word got up to Milwaukee, at Courthouse Square, which at that time was called Courthouse Square, it's now Cathedral Square, a crowd estimated at up to 5,000 gathered to protest the capture of Glover. Sherman Booth, the editor of a local abolitionist paper, got on his horse, ran around the square rallying people, while at the same time saying that we shouldn't break the law, but raising enough ire in people that it caused a group of people to pick up a battering ram. It was a timber from the nearby St. John's Cathedral, which was just being completed in construction, and they used that to break down the jail door and get him in a buggy and take him on the first of a number of stops on the Underground Railroad.
Talk a little bit about the Underground Railroad. How extensive was it?
More so in Wisconsin than the average person from the East is aware. That's one of the things we're attempting to remedy through this book and another one that we're beginning to work on, and that is that the Underground Railroad did not stop at the Ohio River. But with the establishment of Missouri in 1820 and then settlers coming into Wisconsin from the northeast around 1830, 1840, you had another natural setup for the beginnings of an underground railroad with a slave state just a little couple of hundred miles below a free state.
And what people risked a lot.
They did. They risked their fortunes. They risked their freedom to do this. And these were primarily very religious people from the Northeast who considered slavery just a flat-out sin and would not tolerate it.
And so the network, how was it, I'm interested, how was it public? You couldn't publicize it.
No, you couldn't publicize it.
So how did people know?
Primarily word of mouth. But one of the first things that we have to say is that probably the vast majority of slaves who made it to freedom in the North did so through their own efforts with very little or no help from others. But as a result of the help that was done and the fact that a number of the abolitionists had the good fortune to live many years, as they aged and got beyond any danger that anything could happen to them because slavery was over, they began to write about it in their memoirs. And that is how we've been able to learn what some of the various stops were on the Underground Railroad.
Oh, interesting. And as you say, there were a lot of them stops in Wisconsin.
Yes. Well, in the case of Glover himself, if we don't count the jail as a stop on the Underground Railroad, there were about 9 or 10 others that he spent time in, ranging from overnight to several days, being moved around through Milwaukee, Walworth, Waukesha, and Racine counties, being in and out of Racine County at least 2 times, maybe 3, in the course of about 6 weeks. And approximately 6 weeks after he was captured, he was then placed in a grain warehouse on the banks of Racine, on banks of Lake Michigan there, and until a steamship friendly to abolitionism came in, put on that, and then off to Canada.
Taken off to Canada. You know, one of the things I thought was interesting in your book, Ruby, was the sort of the communication network that existed among slaves at the time and how they were able to get information, learn things, and pass it on. And maybe you could talk a little about that.
I think it's very, very interesting to see to what degree one can go to get what they need and the way that they can pass information on. One of the major part ways that they did it was that there was always a housemaid or a house servant or a house slave, and she or he worked in the house preparing many times for very fancy dinners and the big shots and the big wheels of the area would meet. But because they were just slaves, they considered them absolutely no threat at
invisible,
all.
Invisible, yeah.
Yes, invisible. They don't even know who they are or care, you know, in that sense. And so, and they acted that way so that they could soon gather what information was being said over the dinner table to the slaves who worked in the fields. And they could spread that from word to mouth. When they went to their church meeting or their gatherings, they passed the word along in their songs and hymns, that I'm sure you're many of you have heard. They passed the information on to them so that they could learn. To one perfect example of being able to pass information along, we asked, well, how did Joshua get from St. Louis to Racine? How did he know how to go there? Well, one example we suspect, and I think we could be pretty sure of this, is that 10 years prior to that, a runaway slave named Carolyn Qualls, from St. Louis as well, ran away from her mistress and came to Wisconsin, and she's considered to be the first known Underground Railroad passenger that came through Wisconsin on the Underground Railroad. So you see what extent they were. Many of them came along. They slept during the day and moved during the night. The stamina and the strength and the commitment that each person had is just phenomenal, the way they went about with the determination to find their freedom. And that's why this book is so important to us.
And the result of Joshua being freed or taken out of the jail and moved around, I know the fellow who sort of volunteered, I think, just on the spur of the moment to cart him away.
Messenger,
Was one of the people, I think, who was involved in lawsuits then from the person who had purchased Joshua Glover.
Right, yeah. Garland filed a whole bunch of lawsuits against anyone he could that he felt was involved in it, which would have taken their fortunes if he had prevailed in it. The Wisconsin Supreme Court largely refused to pay attention to the Fugitive Slave Act and declared it to be unconstitutional. This is the first states' rights thing before the Civil War even started in the South. And to this day, the Supreme Court has not altered their decision on that. They have refused to accept it. There's no record of it ever having affected their decisions positively.
And if I'm not mistaken, Wisconsin was at least the first or maybe the only state to declare that act unconstitutional.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
Up to this day.
Yeah.
And so the lawsuits and so forth went on for years.
Years they did.
Yes.
Which, in essence, did cause financial ruin.
Yes, it can bankrupt people, and did.
And did. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Talking about, it's actually a fascinating story of Joshua Glover, and that's the principal character in the book, Finding Freedom, The Untold Story of Joshua Glover, Runaway Slave. And join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd be happy to have you join in. And as a matter of fact, we probably should take some calls. Let's go to Tom in Verona first. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Well, this is a fascinating story, and I'm glad you brought it up. But I was wondering about the movie rights. Have you sold the movie rights?
We have not sold the movie rights yet, and we have retained them ourselves. So if you'd like to make a movie, let us know.
And I'm serious about this now. I have a friend in Michigan who is an independent producer, film producer. He spent 20 years in Hollywood, mostly making documentaries. And he moved back to Michigan because his father built a golf course and on a farm, and the farm was the station on the Underground Railroad over there. And I'd like to get in contact with you and see if he'd be interested in, just talk about it.
Yeah. And Mac, how could Tom get
I can give him a number where he can reach me. Mm-hmm. 262-637-1800.
262-637-1800.
Is that an area code 608?
No, that's a Racine area code.
A Racine area code.
Yes.
Yeah, well, this is a wild shot, but I would just love to produce a movie like this. And if I can get my friend he recently had a little falling out with his father too, so he's back in the film business. So.
Okay,
thanks, dude.
We would love to have you join us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Ken in Madison next. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would just like to make a couple of comments about the book. I'm a retired high school history teacher, and read this book and just really wish that Ruby and Mac had written it while I was still teaching. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to teach the history of people versus the history of institutions. I thoroughly enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much.
Very well done. And really think it's a significant addition to the history of the state of Wisconsin.
Oh,
believe that.
Ken, thank you so much for calling. And Mac, it's nice to hear those kinds of things.
It is indeed.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ken. Louise in Hillsboro, we'll go to you next. Hi, Louise. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention I'm from Vernon County, obviously outside of Hillsboro, and live on some land that actually was once owned by one of the slaves that came up through the Underground Railroad, and his family still owns land in the area, and they come out for a family reunion every year from Milwaukee. Oh. And I was just wondering if you were aware of Vernon County as being part of the Underground Railroad.
Oh, yes, I am, and I have been up to one of the family reunions. And
oh, you have?
Yes, and it's fascinating to see how they feel so great at being home and, you know, the background of their family and still the connection there. And so, and I understand that recently there was a marker put up in recognition of the families. Is that so?
I think. In fact, part of the family is actually going to, actually they live on the land right behind us. And, I think they're actually going to be coming up to stay. I mean, I think they're going to actually actively live on that land again, which would be really neat.
Oh, so. That's great. What's interesting about that family is that, Mr. Arms, which was one of the founders there, Samuel Arms, and he was a drummer. He was a slave in my hometown of Millersville, Georgia. Ran away twice, and they beat him severely, but he still got away.
And, fantastic.
And so it's a great story. It's a great story.
Well, I feel very honored to know them.
Thank you, Louise.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. And you do talk about some of the, in passing in the book, about some of the other families, and maybe was Vernon County mentioned in the book? I can't remember now, but I thought there were some, you mentioned some families who farmed sort of as an aside at some point in the book, or maybe I'm confusing your book with another book, but
maybe,
I don't think
I
so.
I don't recall myself whether
it was in passing. I remember it was in kind of in passing.
It's probably in passing because I was a part of the Old World Wisconsin exhibit for some of the families who lived, you know, at the time, because so many people don't recognize that we've been here for a very long time. And so many times I have to go to conferences and you get up and you say what your name is and where you're from. And so I'd get some, I'm Ruby West Jackson, I'm from Wisconsin. They say, Wisconsin? There are no black people in Wisconsin.
Oh, my goodness.
So we all have to learn our history, and people are just amazed that we've been here for so long and made such a contribution to the state and feel like, hey, this is home. This is our home, too.
Joy in West Bend, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Joy.
Thanks for the program.
Sure.
And I just want to thank the guests for studying this subject. I think it's wonderful as a Caucasian to have something to be proud about, the Underground Railroad and the abolitionists. I wanted to ask about how many women and children there were in relation to how many men there were who were runaway slaves. And then my other question would be, isn't there an African-American actor with the last name of Glover, and does he have any familial ties to the man that you have been talking about?
Hmm. We don't have any specific information about the number of children, the number of women or men. We know that whole families did make the trip, and that most of the people who made the trip made it solo.
Yeah. And as I recall from the book, oftentimes, as you were early in your book, when you're talking about sales of these people, that sometimes a mother and daughter would be just separated, pulled apart, and
yes,
sold separately, and to go off to live in totally different places.
Yes, and also if you continue to read that one paragraph, also says about in some cases the place, things were so awful and so distressful that the mother often ended their children's lives as well as their own.
Yeah, rather than to sell them off.
Yes.
And have them sold off. Joy, I thank you very much. Joanne in Jacksonport, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. This is really an exciting program. A couple of years ago, we went through part of Ontario on our way to visit relatives in the Penian area of New York. And I can't remember whether it was near London or Woodstock. There was an area that was, one of those little towns was the end of one of the Underground Railroad routes. And the town had had a thriving black population mid-1800s, and there were, like, I think they said 10 flourishing churches. And as years went by, they kind of disappeared. But there's museums, et cetera, and we were in a tight time schedule, so we couldn't stop and look. But I wondered if you had any information with my vague description about which those towns are. I mean, that's like having half the story. But that was so interesting to actually be someplace where they said it all stopped here and they had this very large population.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do remember a couple of places, and I was surprised when we first went to Canada looking for Joshua and was not successful. We found a number of museums. Did you visit the Walls Museum and Distressed, I think it is.
Dresden.
Yes. And even the one about Carolyn Qualls with Woods in Windsor, which was then known as Sandwich. So there are many there who were aiding those that came over because it was so easy for the masters or just slave catchers and cross over on the Detroit River and snatch the runaway slaves. And even though they weren't necessarily being pursued, they could always get them and sell them back in the States. Mm. So it was difficult times.
Yeah. Thank you, Joanne. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Harry in Hartford next. Harry, hi to you.
Fine, thank you. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I grew up in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. Are you aware that there is an octagon house there that, as we were growing up, we were always told it was part of the Underground Railroad?
Yes, we are familiar with it, and we were very glad to hear. And we're always happy to hear any news about the Underground Railroad.
We've been to the Octagon House.
So we have been there. The only thing that our book is not a very large book, but it's thoroughly researched and documented, and that's what we had to do, and that's why it took us 12 years to do it. But we have to look at every aspect of it. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, when we were looking at this particular piece of property, it was thought that the house was not quite old enough to be a part of the Underground Railroad. Had all the other aspects of, you know, that gave a checklist going down and the way they did it. And there was a tunnel going back down to, I don't know, Pewaukee River or Rock River. But that one item about whether that house was old enough was questioned to us, and we have to make sure that what we say in this book is correct.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. Thank you.
Thanks, Harry. And Stephen in Jefferson, it's your turn. Hi, Stephen.
I just wanted you to know, well, everybody knows that there's been a lot of freeway work done in Milwaukee lately. And when they replaced the bridge on the 43 at Silver Spring, they cast into the bridge underneath the overpass a frieze, very stunning frieze, of a runaway slave being chased by men and dogs. It's quite a stirring thing, and I think it's great that it's there to spark interest.
I'm not familiar with that one, are you?
Yes, I've heard about it vaguely, but I don't know it in detail. But I understand it's really quite something to see.
Thank you. And so that's something. Where is it again now, Stephen?
It's underneath the 43 as you get off at Silver Springs.
Silver Springs, okay.
So it's part of the bridge, and I'm very glad it's there just to stir appreciation of the topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much for calling. And you know what? Here we are. You said early on, Mac, that most of the stories about Joshua Glover ended with, and then he went to Canada, and we never got to his trip to Canada, and here we are out of time. So, but you know, that's a really interesting part of the book, and maybe it's a good thing not to cover everything in the book. We have certainly haven't covered everything in the book anyway. It's a wonderful book, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's available, I'm sure. People can order they can order from probably directly from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, right. Or they can order. I mean, any local bookstore,
bookstores should have it as well, and that would include Barnes and Noble.
Sure. So and go online and get it too. But your local bookstore is a great place to go as well. And I appreciate you both taking the time to be with us today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much for asking us. It was a great pleasure.
We enjoyed it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I enjoyed reading it, and I hope everybody reads it. Ruby West Jackson and Walter T. McDonald are co-authors of Finding Freedom, The Untold Story of Joshua Glover, Runaway Slave. It's a fascinating story. They were doing a great job of telling it here, and I appreciate all your calls and questions about it as well. Again, it's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Thanks to both of you. Coming up, we're going to be talking about protecting your rights as a consumer. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.